Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us and sticking with us. We had a little bit of technical difficulty this afternoon, so I appreciate you staying and joining us just a few minutes late. I am Shelly Kino, and this is Hashtag No Limits. Hashtag No Limits is about people who society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, "We know who we are, but not who we will become." And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is no better example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. The caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells and then reforms into a butterfly. Then, as if that's not difficult and strenuous enough, it then has to fight to get out of the cocoon in order for its wings to be strong enough to carry it everywhere it needs to go. And I just recently saw a t-shirt through a teacher's website that said, "If nothing ever changed, we would never have butterflies." So I thought that was really very neat, and I'm going to have to get that on something, and because it just seems to fit with my logo and my idea for this show. And today my guest is Kim Hopkins, and Kim works for, you know, and I keep interchanging this first word to lives and lives in the balance, and I think both are appropriate for what we're going to talk about, but I will let you tell me the official name. So Kim, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. It's officially Lives in the Balance.
Lives in the Balance. And that's what I think. And then I'm like, oh, but wait, was that what I said? And then, yeah, so then I keep interchanging it back and forth again. So just to go over the business side of things, for anyone who is watching live, please give us a hashtag live and let us know where you're watching from. If you're watching in the replay, hashtag live or hashtag replay and let us know where you're watching from. And if you have any questions for Kim or any comments that you would like me to make sure to get her, make sure you leave those in the comments. And if you're watching in the replay, I will make sure to forward those. And if you're watching live, I will make sure to pop them up. Okay, so all of that stuff's done. So Kim, tell us about yourself and tell us about the organization that you work with.
Sure. Well, I'm a clinical social worker, and I have been for more years than I care to remember. And I wasn't always trained in the collaborative and proactive solutions model. In fact, I was trained in the exact opposite of the collaborative and proactive solutions model. Okay. And I didn't find Dr. Green's model until I was probably a handful of years into my career in working in residential care with some really, really, really challenging youth. And a few things were going on. We were noticing that we were restraining kids a lot. We were holding them on the floor a lot, and kids were getting hurt, and staff was getting hurt. I had gotten hurt a couple of times. And it didn't seem to be as therapeutic as we were being trained that it was. Mm-hmm. And it certainly didn't seem to be a deterrent. So that was something that was happening, and this was in the state of Massachusetts, and the state at the time was encouraging providers to reconsider treatment models that they were subscribing to make sure that they were evidence-based and that they were portable. Portable meaning that they didn't just work in like staff-secure settings with tons mm-hmm. of adults around, that they were also something that parents could learn to do or foster homes could implement. And so we had to change what we were doing in terms of our main therapeutic model. And then we were also noticing that kids who made gains in some of our programs and then maybe stepped down to a less restrictive setting or went back home or went back from to their community school from our special ed day school, they often didn't sustain those gains after they moved to less staff secure settings. So all this happening, and just by luck, somebody said to me, you know, if you need credits for your license, you might want to go hear this guy speak. His name's Dr. Ross Green. He's very a good speaker. I didn't know I was going to like find the answer to all the things that my organization was dealing with at that point. And he was going to be speaking in Freeport, Maine, which is the home of L.L. Bean. There's great shopping there. So I thought, yeah. low risk. If he's bad, I'm out and I'm shopping.
Yeah.
But I did not leave early. And I was like, wow, this is the answer to everything. And that started a several year journey of making a 180 degree shift from how we were doing things to how we needed to do things. And even in early days when we weren't good at the model yet, we saw incredible, incredible results. And that just sort of started everything. And then when I was ready to make a change, because residential care requires that you work a lot of hours and you're on call and all of that, I ended up meeting up with Dr. Green, and he had a project that was happening near where I lived, and it just sort of was serendipity, and started working for him, gosh, must be 15 or so years ago at this point. And started teaching his model, and then about maybe 7 years ago became the director of outreach for his nonprofit, Lives in the Balance.
Oh, okay. Wow, that's quite the journey. So what I want to get into today, I have been a special education teacher for more years, again, than I would like to count. And I started off going through a training where restraints were taught, and they were taught, you know, to be, we did have some face down restraints at, you know, as a very last effort. And then after a couple of years of that sort of training, then they switched the training to where you didn't lay kids down anymore. And, you know, do those kinds of things, but there were still restraints within that training. And I found that, those weren't absolutely necessary. You know, the rest of the training that I was given in this program, and it's not the program that you're talking about, there was so much more to it that if we were able to spend more time with the whole child, and working on teaching the right behaviors, I take that back, teaching the wanted behaviors, because I see you're smiling, and so you can correct me or tell me the opinion of Lives in the Balance, but there isn't a quote unquote right behavior that is across the board in every situation for every person in every classroom. And I say that because what I can tolerate in my classroom and what I am willing to allow isn't the same as maybe the teacher across the hall, and isn't the same as the parent, and isn't the same as the neighbor who's watching your child. So that's what I mean by that there's not just a right behavior. And that I had a parent of a child with a disability teach me the wanted and unwanted words to use for behavior. So I've started using those. And so I would like to talk with you about the more about the ways that you had been doing it and why those things weren't as successful as then the 180 flip that you did, and why what you're doing now is so much more successful.
Well, I think like a lot of professionals, educators, parents, we're all taught the best way to help kids is to make sure they have the motivation they need to do well. And I call it being in the make 'em wanna business. And I was in the make 'em wanna business for a long time because we believed that kids did well if they wanted to. And if they weren't doing well, it's because they lacked what they needed in terms of motivation to do well. And that line of thinking only gives you one way to intervene. You know, you reward the things that you like seeing, and you consequence the things you don't like seeing. And then you sort of hope for the best, right? And then we sort of scratch our heads like, why isn't this working for this kid, right? And what the research shows, and this is 50 plus years of research that has accumulated at this point, is that that's actually not true. That it's not that kids do well if they wanna, it's that kids do well if they can. And when they're not doing well, something is getting in their way of doing well. And what's getting in the way, that's what we, being their partners, need to figure out. And we can do that by figuring out, you know, the why and the when. We say we got to answer those two important questions. And the research tells us it's sort of the 10,000 foot view on why kids are exhibiting concerning behaviors is because they lack the skills not to. And the 10,000 foot view on when is, you know, when that happens is when an expectation is placed on them that requires skills that they can't bring to bear. Right. And so we view behavior as just a signal. It's a signal that there was a problem that they didn't have the skills to solve. And so many programs, I mean, that's what I was taught. It's actually how Dr. Green was taught, are so focused on looking at the behavior and the frequency and the intensity and the target and all of that. And behavior is not the only observable data, and it turns out it's not the important observable data because it can trick you, you know, because runners run, hitters hit, but they're running and hitting for all different reasons. Mm-hmm. And it's those reasons we actually need to know, the problems they didn't know how to solve because they lacked the skills to solve those problems. And so we're not focused on behavior, we're focused on unsolved problems. And when we work with kids and we partner with them proactively, as the name of the model suggests, to solve problems, we extinguish behavior because the problem's solved. So they don't have to signal.
Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. And yeah, that has been my belief for quite some time, is exactly what you just said. And I don't know if I had heard it from Dr. Green at some point, or if it was just something that I sort of figured out on my own. I don't remember. I've not really honestly known about Dr. Green for that many years, but the more I get into what he teaches and what you all are doing at Lives in the Balance is the same beliefs that I've had. And so, like I said, I don't know if somewhere along the way it got into my system without me knowing who to attribute it to, or if it's just that I happen to think the same way that you all do as far as behaviors are concerned. And I do workshops and trainings on behaviors. And one of the things that I often tell is, I become a toddler when I start looking at somebody's behaviors, because I start asking why. Why is this happening? Why are they doing this? What are they missing? What needs to be taken care of that's not being taken care of? And so it's not exactly what you said, but it's kind of, you know, in the ballpark, I think, of what you were talking about, as far as there's, like you said, it's a signal, and you just have to find what the behavior is communicating, which is another thing that I say frequently, is all behavior is communication, because it's telling us something. Even the positive behaviors or the wanted behaviors tell us something. Mm-hmm. We just tend not to worry about what the why is behind those behaviors, because those we like. So yeah, we just kind of look for why is that one that we don't want happening? And so do you agree that all behaviors are communicating something?
Yeah, we very much see behavior as communication, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yep. And it means it's time for us adults and caregivers to get curious.
Yeah. Yeah. And I so appreciate what you say about, it's not that they don't want to, it's that they can't. And we have to figure out why they can't. And then fill in the gaps.
Yeah. And I mean, we have done a good job of teaching our expectations and what we want to have happen and what we don't want to have happen. So they're pretty clear on that. And yet, you know, they don't wake up in the morning thinking, okay, at 1:13 this afternoon, I'm going to rip up my math quiz and run out of the room. And they know we don't want that, but it happens anyway. So it's time to get curious. What was that about? And we very much believe that kids, that doing well is preferable to not doing well, which seems like a really basic concept. But when you spend a little time with it, we realize that a lot of models are not actually teaching us that that's the case. That, you know, why would kids not want to do well? Life's going so great for them, you know, and as much as us caregivers are bothered by the behavior we got to deal with, the kids are much more bothered by it. They're losing out far more than we are. And, you know, I think the pandemic definitely showed us that we all do the best we can in the circumstances we find ourselves in. And that is true for kids. So they would like to do well. They know what's expected, you know, and yet they don't pull it off. So it's time to get curious about that.
Yeah. And that's, that kind of lines up with something else that I teach, which is that behaviors are personal, but to the person exhibiting the behavior, not to the person receiving the behavior. And so oftentimes I would have teachers or paraprofessionals that would take a child's behaviors as if it was a malicious attack on that person. And exactly what you just said, you know, they don't want to be that way. They don't wake up and think, how can I ruin my parents' or my teacher's day today? Or how can I make it difficult for them? kids don't do that.
No. And if, and you know, and it's unfortunate that a lot of the ways we've taught to parent and educate, provide services to kids doesn't actually teach us that. But it's true. And we spend a lot of time being upset with kids, which means we can't partner with them and we can't help them the way that we want to help them, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that I shared a few years ago, and I still share every so often, sorry, is that the Bill of Rights, the Behavior Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit about those?
Sure. It's essentially a set of values that that we believe that kids are entitled to, and we believe that adults want to provide to them. And it just sort of spells it out, you know, in pretty specific ways about, you know, how you could look at it as like how to create a classroom culture would be one way to look at it, or a school culture. Like, these are the things that we want to value. Everybody deserves to be heard. And, you know, we give each other the benefit of the doubt and things like that, that really make the kids do well if they can sentiment kind of live and breathe. And, you know, one of the things we do at Lives in the Balance is to give away the collaborative and proactive solutions model for free, video and audio and downloadable format. But the other thing we do is we advocate on behalf of kids who exhibit these concerning behaviors and the people who are caring for them and educating them and providing services to them. And so if you read the Bill of Rights, or if you read our values in maybe another way on our website, we encourage you to sign up and join us and be an advocator. There's big ways to advocate and there's teeny tiny ways to advocate. And, you know, if you think like, gee, I'd like to, but I don't have time, it doesn't take any time. You don't have to do anything on the bigger list, right? But with their strength in numbers, and we're trying very hard to get lawmakers and others to listen about what kids need and what their educators need and their parents need and their service providers need to do right by them. So if you agree with that set of values, please sign up to be an advocate on our website, which is livesinthebalance.org.
Yeah, and I'm going to actually share the website.
Great.
So you can see that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so yeah, I love just this first page, when kids get paddled, when kids get arrested, when kids get secluded, suspended, and trying to restrained. I was trying to remember what all the different words were. They get lost. And, you know, I have seen so often in school districts where there's a one size fits all behavior model. Mm-hmm. And it does often fall to detention, suspension, expulsion.
Yep.
And they too often, in my opinion, do not look again at the why. Why does this behavior? And what has always baffled me is that it's the repetition of a behavior. And so a child gets a detention and then they do the behavior again and they get another detention and they do the behavior again and they get another detention. To me, I think, who's the slow learner in that scenario? You know, I mean, I'm glad that you find that humorous, because that means you understand what I'm saying. I was always surprised, like, do you not understand that what you're doing isn't working? So we need to do so. Well, that's the policy. Well, that's how we do it here. Well, that's, you know, we can't do something different for this child than we do for the whole middle school or the high school or, you know, this grade level or this class. I'm like, yeah, you can. You're an educator. You're supposed to educate. And so do you see that kind of stuff on a regular basis, where people are just stuck in that mindset of they do A and we do B? Every time they do A, we always do B.
Oh, yes. And a lot of it's out of fear. A lot of it's out of scarcity of resources or not knowing what to do, right? But all these interventions that are underlined here and popping up, right? Those are interventions. They're just super late. And so, you know, and you're right, they don't work. If they were going to get the job done, they would have gotten the job done, right? They don't work.
Right.
And just so your viewers know why paddling is on there, because they might be in a state where that's not allowed, thinking we don't do that in this country, but we do. In 19 states, paddling is legal in public education, and it is used about 200,000 times a year, let alone detentions and suspensions and exclusion and arrests and all that, right? And these are all very late interventions. We need to be early. We need to figure out what is upstream here. What is pushing the kid in the water to begin with? When they're in the water, they're doing their behavior. What pushes them in? Let's stop responding to behavior and let's start figuring out what kicks this all off into motion. What we're going to find are problems that they didn't know how to solve. And we can partner with them to help them solve problems. We have a three-step process for doing that. And in helping them to solve their problems proactively outside the heat of the moment, we're actually going to teach them a whole host of skills without even thinking about it. It's all kind of informal and backdoor. Mm-hmm. And then they won't be doing behavior so much because they'll have what they need to solve problems and meet expectations.
Right. Can you share some of those just really quickly, just a few ideas that you would give a parent to help them?
Well, yeah. And in our model, there's really two main pieces. The first one is doing the hard work to figure out the why and the when. And we have a single-sided, single sheet of paper called the Assessment of Lagging Skills and Unsolved Problems, or the ALSIP for short. And that's going to help you figure out their lagging skills, or at least take good guesses. You don't have to get too mired down in, you know, worried about, are you right? And then it's going to help you prompt you to figure out all the times those lagging skills play out. In other words, what are the expectations the child's is having trouble meeting? When we do that, the kid becomes predictable, and then we can get ahead of unsolved problems. Because really, the best time to solve a problem is not when the problem's happening. It's before the problem's happening or outside of the problem happening, right? Outside of the expectation being placed on the kid. In order to do that, you got to get a good lay of the land of all the unsolved problems, right? And make a plan. You know, we can't work on everything all at once. So what are your big fish? What one, two, or three unsolved problems are the ones that you're going to work on first? Then you got to get to work. The second big thing is starting to solve problems with your kid, the partner, right? Mm-hmm. And we use partner very, very particularly, even with young children, even with nonverbal children, even with cognitively impaired children, all kids can partner with us in whatever way they can partner, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be through words. But they are our partners in this because, frankly, they have information that if we had, that would make us better helpers. And so we partner with them to work on one problem at a time. And there's a three-step process. And on the website, you can find it's called Plan B. We call it Plan B. There's a cheat sheet for the three steps of Plan B. The first step is called the empathy step. That's where you're gathering information from your partner, the kid, specifically what makes it hard to meet the expectation. And again, even if they don't communicate in words, there are different ways to gather information. Once we've done that, that's actually the hardest step because kids don't say, well, you know, I'm glad you asked. Here's what's happening. You know, my mind is getting stuck and I can't shift from recess mode to math mode. They're not going to just say that. So there's a lot of, we call it drilling kind of ways of asking questions to try to get the information. So that takes time. Step two is where the adult puts their concern on the table. What is the adult worry when the expectation's not being met? It's very quick. It's only a sentence or so. And then step three is the invitation step where we invite the kid to help us solve this problem. What would they like to do that would take care of their concern and the adult's concern? And what's different about this is the way that we're taught to help kids doesn't get any information from them about what's making it hard to do the thing we want them to do. And we're not involving them in solving problems that affect their own lives. We are unilaterally solving things for them because we're the adult, we're in charge, we're helping, but we're robbing them the opportunity to learn how to solve problems and to gain crucial thinking skills that got them in the hot water in the first place.
So. Right. Yeah, those are such excellent points. And, you know, I'm loving talking with you because I feel like I was doing something right as a teacher, because a lot of what you're saying is the same philosophy that I had and the same approach that I used. It wasn't, you know, exactly in your model, but it was that idea of, you know, the kids can help. They're going to give me the information. You know, they're helping me figure out the why. And I happened to work with several students who were non or paraverbal, as well as many students who were verbal. But even the students who are verbal, as you said, you can ask them what's wrong, and they're not necessarily going to know. And they're, even if they know, they still may not be able to verbalize it. And so oftentimes it comes through, at least in my experience, just sort of general conversation. You know, like you could be working side by side, doing something, playing, whatever it is, and be talking to the student, and they will share something and they don't even know that that's the thing that has been driving some of their behaviors. Mm. Have you had that same experience, or would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I think sometimes when we're problem solving with kids, it goes a lot better when it's indirect because yeah. They can't tolerate the direct, and that's fine. You know, we have Jennifer, who works with us, she was a parent volunteer, and now she oversees our social media, and she talks about her son, who's now turning 18. But many years ago when they started this model, it involved him in his bed covered with every blanket and stuffed animal and pillow he had, but his hand sticking out, and she would use what we call the five finger method, and she would take guesses, and he would rate on his fingers how close her guesses were, with one being way off and five being that's totally true. And that's how mm-hmm. their conversations went for a long time. Even though he was verbal, it mm-hmm. was just too much to be, you know, face to face, and it doesn't need to be face to face. It can be shooting right. hoops. It can be in the midst of other kind of play or other kind of activities. You know, your goal is to get information from your partner, because they have information about how their brain is working against them in the situation. If they can give that to you with your help, then you're better positioned to help them solve the problem in a way that's durable and realistic and meets their concerns and yours.
Yeah, that's wow. And so I want to clarify, you know, that what we're talking about is, as a former special education teacher, of course, you know, I was dealing with a lot of unwanted behaviors daily. But it doesn't, this method is not just for kids with severe behaviors or kids who have IEPs or who, and for anybody that doesn't know, an IEP is that special education document that drives their specially designed instruction. This is for anybody, and it's not even just for children, right?
You got it. Yeah. I think the misnomer about the model is the first book, which Dr. Green did not name himself, the publisher did, is called The Explosive Child. So it kind of set this precedent that people think the model is only useful for kids who have these dangerous, aggressive behaviors. But it's really for any kid. And so his book, Raising Human Beings, takes a step in the direction of saying, you know, even for kids like my daughter, who is, I call, you know, she's a crier, pouter, sulker, right? That's her behavioral signal. She's just lucky that she doesn't signal. My son signals in a very unlucky way. He's a screamer, hitter, thrower, right? So it's really just a matter of luck in what your behavioral signal is, because it all depends on what the responses you're getting from the adult, right? Yeah, you know, I'm sort of losing my train of thought because I like to talk about this so much. But your question was, is it for all kids? So yes, absolutely. And not just for kids. We're actually working on a workshop and other stuff to show how this is really useful manager to supervisor in a work setting. We're working on something around how this is used in couples work. Yeah, it's just a great way to problem solve with anyone who is having difficulty meeting an expectation. It's a really respectful, transparent process, and informative and feel good. Because, you know, the ways that we're typically taught to help kids is that it is going to end up with them losing and the adult winning. And in this model, nobody loses. We're going for a win-win here. So it's, again, it's very translatable to not just kids and adults.
And I so much love what you just said about the kid loses and the adult wins. So many times, it doesn't matter what the setting has been that I've been in, and I have seen an adult just dig their heels in, and just, you can just see almost a shift at some, if you watch the whole thing, of their stance of, you know, first it was, okay, well, you're not doing what I wanted you to do. And then it becomes, oh, I'm going to win this argument. You are not going to get one over on me, or you're not going to get away with whatever it is. And that's not healthy for either person in the situation.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we talk about power struggles all the time, and, you know, if you're wanting, and really we need information from our partners to understand what's happening with their brain in the midst of an unsolved problem, and they're not going to give it to us if they're scared of getting in trouble or a consequence or something like that. So we don't want to be power struggling with them. That's just not helpful for anybody who wants to do that, right?
Right.
So this is about getting two sets of concerns on the table. A power struggle is two solutions on the table. Like, you need to do this, I won't do it. Those are two different opposing solutions, right? But if we work to understand what's your concern, you know, what is it about it that you don't want to do it, right? And then what's my concern? What is it about it that makes it important to me? And then we work from how do we get our concerns addressed? Really nice things happen from there. And the more, you know, the more we talk with kids this way and they learn the three steps, they start applying it when we're not around. And that is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, there's a saying, and I don't believe it's from Dr. Green, but I cannot think of, and it's one that I use frequently, and I cannot think of who said it, but it goes something like, when a child is expressing behaviors that you don't want, instead of looking at the child as attention seeking, consider that the child is connection seeking. And I think that goes along with what you said with, you know, that if you have concerns versus, you know, well, you have to do my solution. Mm-hmm. The mindset approach is different, and it's okay. How can we address your concern? How can we connect with you to, you know, for both of us to move forward? And it's so difficult, I think, being a parent, being a teacher, being an adult in authority over children, because unfortunately we could say one or two unhappy things once and the child is going to hold on to that. So if you've had that experience, can you speak to how we can help solve that to make that child feel comfortable and loved and secure, like you talked about?
I think we have to stop doing what we call traditional discipline or plan A. We got to get out of the make them wanna business and believe that they already wanna and tell them that and say things like, you know, we thought we were helping you when we had you sit out from recess, or we thought we were helping you when we took away your video games, or whatever it might have been. And now we realize that not only was it not helping, it kind of made things worse because our relationship is not super solid because we did that. And there's other downsides too. Like, you know, if a kid lacks critical thinking skills, for example, in the areas of flexibility, frustration tolerance, problem solving, right? And you come in with an intervention that's plan A and traditional in nature, you're going to make their behavior worse because they're not going to have the skills to adjust to your edict of your unilateral way you're going to solve this, right? So whole host of things happen. So we gotta recognize that we're taught to do that, and that's actually not helping kids who lack skills, right? And then we need to be, I would say, open with kids about how we thought we were being helpful when we did those things, but now we're realizing it kind of made things worse. And we're looking to partner with them to figure out what gets in their way when there's different expectations they're having trouble meeting. We're going to work on them one at a time. And then we're going to figure out how to get their concern met and ours, not just ours. And then you start using Plan B, the CPS model, to solve problems. And, you know, kids see in that process that we talk about not forcing things. You know, if you have a kid who's like, I'm not talking to you, then you assume they have a good reason. You tell them that, you know, we say honesty really disarms, you know, we're not trying to make you do anything. We're just trying to understand so we can help. If now is not a good time, let's try again tomorrow, which is another show of faith that you're not trying to force things, because if we're using Plan A, we're typically trying to force things, right?
Right.
And so Plan B is very relationship building, very. And it's very transparent and very honest and very respectful. And kids start to get that when they see us putting, you know, our money where our mouth is, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's fabulous, and that's exactly where I was thinking. And this is something that this is very intentional in mindset thinking, and it takes practice. Because I'll be honest, I am a substitute now, and so I'm not dealing with behaviors that I don't tolerate on a daily basis all day long anymore. And so when I go into a classroom now and I get some behaviors that start to rub me the wrong way, I have to, like, that initial instinct is still, even though I have practiced so much and for so many years more of what you're talking about, that initial instinct is still to make them stop a particular behavior or make them do something a particular way. And I had to catch myself just recently and go, okay, you know, this child is behaving this way because something is off. They're not happy. And, you know, you can't get mad at them. And so I was like talking myself through the things again, because it's not all the time that I am putting this into play. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, well, for me, I always talk about how at work, I'm really good at this model. At home, there are times when I'm not on my game. I might be sick or tired or something like that, right? Or dealing with something heavy. And it does take, you know, if the model can be applied emergently in the heat of the moment, right? It's not where you get your best work done. It's just sort of a way to get things back to baseline, but you're not going to do any skills teaching in the heat of the moment. And certainly when we're in the heat of the moment, it takes a lot of emotional energy on the part of the adult, instead of saying, you know, stop that or knock that off, to say, you seem to be having a hard time. What's going on? You're not in trouble. I'd really like to understand so I can help, right? Like, it takes a lot to do that. Now, of course, we're saying a lot these days, we want to get you out of the heat of the moment, you know, by doing the ALSEP and making the kid predictable and starting to use proactive Plan B. And then there's also Plan C. I mentioned Plan A and Plan B. There's also Plan C, which isn't the model, but we like it. It's where some of those expectations that the kid can't meet, if you're not working on them, you're going to drop temporarily, which is really stabilizing. And it's about prioritizing, right? So in combination of using Plan C with proactive Plan B, things start moving in the right direction, and we get you out of needing to be in the heat of the moment. And, you know, part of the impetus of being proactive is not just so the kid's in good shape when you're having this conversation, it's so the adult is too, right?
Right.
Because, you know, we get caught off guard and surprised by behavior signals sometimes, especially if we haven't done an ALSEP yet, or maybe there was an unsolved problem that we didn't have on the ALSEP or we didn't know about, or it's a new expectation. And we're not usually in the right frame of mind to drop what we're doing and figure it all out, right? So, so we're not trying to come up with durable solutions to problems and teach skills in the heat of the moment. We're just trying to get out of the heat of the moment.
Right.
And using the ALSEP and a combination of proactive B and proactive C, that's a way to stay out of the heat of the moment.
Yeah. Now, is this a 100% every time it's always going to work model? Or, I mean, are there still those times when, you know, you do, even if you're applying your model 100%, that there's still going to be a chink in the armor. Something's going to pop up that you are going to find yourself in the heat of the moment every once in a while.
Sometimes that can happen. We work very hard to make it not happen at the best of our ability, you know. But right. Say a kid changes classrooms, and like you mentioned at the top of the program, that classroom is going to maybe have different expectations, right? So in that learning period, we might not know what of the new expectations that the kid will have trouble with, right? We can try to get ahead of that the best that we can, but we might not know, for example. You know, and we often get asked, would we say this works for 100% of kids? We haven't met the kid yet that we haven't been able to make some progress with, you know, and progress, of course, looks different for every kid. And we're not saying, you know, if a kid has, many of the kids we work with have 50, 75 unsolved problems, right? We're not saying you're going to solve all of those at once. In fact, we're being very open that you can't. Like, you're going to work on one at a time and make progress that way. And you're going to be choosy about the unsolved problems you pick to work on, because you want to look at the ones you actually have a shot of getting to go better. You know, if you're thinking about, like, if you're coming from the school's perspective, you're probably not going to have high success on an unsolved problem that's home-based, at least not at the beginning, and unless you're working in concert with the people at home, and same for vice versa. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot more to say on that, but maybe that's where I'll pause for a sec in case you have any follow-up.
Well, and I really appreciate what you're saying, and I hope that the listeners are catching it, that this is not a quick fix.
Right.
That this is something that is going to take time. It's going to take effort. And I often think that was a lot of the problem in the schools where I've worked. And I've worked in amazing schools, and the students that I've worked with were not terribly severe. I mean, I know that there are, I've worked with some that were much, much more severe, and these teachers cared. And I don't want it to come across that these teachers didn't care. I think that from an educator standpoint, they have so many things that they are trying to accomplish that having this cookie cutter approach is easiest, and it doesn't require a lot of thought. And the program that you're talking about, and the programs that I tried to implement and do with my students and students who weren't my students, but I knew were those ones who were getting those detentions constantly and the behavior wasn't changing. You got to put the effort in. And I think you mentioned it earlier that the younger that you can, if you can see these things, the younger that you can start working with them, the better the success, but not all the behaviors are there at young ages.
Yeah, sure. As expectations change over time, but yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there was, again, I'm losing my words again. I must be tired today. There was something else I wanted to say based on what you just said. It'll come to me.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'm just glad it's not only me that does that.
You know, I blame it. I always say, oh man, you know, having two kids, they just suck the brain out of you. But I was always a little flighty before that. just being honest. Man, there was something you said that I definitely wanted to, it's gone at the moment.
Okay. Well, yeah, hopefully it will come back. So we've got about 15 minutes. So I want to make sure that, you know, we cover, how people, I know I'll put the website back up here. And you know, how people can access it, how, what sort of helps that you give them, if their parents or if their schools, or I know you talked about, you know, you're trying to put some things together for businesses. And actually, when I do my presentations, it's titled Understanding Behavior Lessons for a Lifetime, because it truly does go. The things that I teach, and it certainly is seeming like the things that you all teach, does the same thing, that you can take the principles and apply them to any relationship.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're lacking a skill as a kid, it doesn't mean you just get it when you turn 18.
Right. Right.
And a lot of people want to know our opinion on why people lack skills. Well, the research doesn't actually agree on that. You know, certainly exposure to trauma often results in some lagging skills, right? And yet, not always, and yet some people lack skills who never were exposed to trauma. So the research does not agree on why, and it doesn't matter to us, the intervention's the same. And so, you know, if you're like me, and I was a kid who lacked the skill to handle a change in plan or routine, and, you know, my parents did the best they knew. What they were taught was that I just wanted my own way. So I have to learn that I can't always have my own way, right? As opposed to, oh, you know, every time we make a change, she has a hard time, right? And so I become an adult. And guess what? I still have a hard time when the plan changes. Right. And when you're running the clinical department for 12 programs, your plan changes constantly, and you,
right?
you don't get to finish your nice, neat to-do list and all that. Right. And so, now I wasn't like throwing chairs over it. My behavioral signal was quite lucky, but it still didn't work with relationships. I would get anxious and I would maybe get short with people, and that didn't translate well. So it wasn't like,
right,
outrageous, not hurting anybody. And yet it still didn't really work well in relationships. And so,
right,
part of finding Dr. Green's work was going, oh my gosh, that isn't intentional on my part. Like, I just don't know how to deal when there's a change in the plan or the routine. I'm cognitively rigid in that way. How do I start working on this? And that led me to a path of developing some strategies that work for me to this day. It took a little bit of trial and error, which goes to your point earlier too, about like how well this works. Like, sometimes first solutions don't work. And that's true for us adults as we're solving our own problems. Sometimes, mm-hmm, it's a little bit of experimenting. But then, you know, I landed on some solutions that work for me today and help me handle changes in routine and plan, which happen all the time. So thank goodness, right, I no longer feel the anxiety or have the resulting behavioral signal. So, yes, very much applicable, and we're playing the long game here, you know, teaching skills for life and not just to do well in this setting right now, but it's to do well beyond.
Right, and I think as educators especially, and I keep going back to educators because that's what the majority of my life was spent doing, and that's where children spend the majority of their time outside of the home, is the money. The money that we could spend to help children understand their behaviors and understand the why behind it and help fill in any gaps if there are any, or help heal the trauma if that is if there's a possibility of that, is tremendous compared to the amount of money that it would be a tremendous savings to do it at the younger age compared to how much money we spend on things, services that they need because they're into whatever they get into if their behaviors aren't addressed and they aren't helped at an early age. I just read a quote from Rick Lavoie, and I don't know if you're familiar with who he is. And he said that prison systems will look at the literacy level of third graders to determine how many prisons and the size of those prisons that will be needed in 20 years.
I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. If you know, and it's not just literacy. I mean, that's one of the skills deficits that we're talking about that cause a lot of behaviors is academic struggles, mm-hmm, not necessarily a trauma, but just academic struggles. And that just floored me when
Yeah.
I heard that.
Yeah. We have a documentary that you can watch completely for free, also on our website. You'll find it under advocacy, under public relations, public awareness. And it's called The Kids We Lose. And it gets to all these issues about, like you said, you know, teachers are not coming to work thinking, how do I ruin a kid's day today, right?
Right, exactly.
The system is broken. And, you know, we're spending lots of money on out-of-district placement and putting police in schools and stuff like that. And we're not spending it on giving teachers the tools they need to handle what they're seeing in the classroom, right? And so, and then, like, you have some states taking away the ability to restrain and seclude. But are they giving teachers what to do instead, right? You can't, I mean, it's, we're happy to see those practices go away, and it's magical thinking to think, right, well, they'll just figure it out. Like, they need to know what to do instead. It's, you know, as one of the educators in the documentary says, it's like a battlefield out there, you know, in some of these classrooms. So, and yes, the school-to-prison pipeline is a very real thing. Our documentary speaks to that and how much money is being spent, misspent in that respect. So it's a hard watch. It's supposed to be an expose. It's supposed to be showing lawmakers what teachers and educators and parents are dealing with and kids are dealing with because the system is broken and what we need to do to fix it. There's some actual footage of paddling and things like that. So it is a very hard watch. And yet it makes the point, and many of the points that you made. I also want to mention that there's a lot of great research done on the effectiveness of the collaborative and proactive solutions model. And some of the most poignant research comes out of Maine's youth detention system, so jail for kids in Maine, where, you know, going back 13, 14, 15 years, they had the worst recidivism rates in the country. So like 82% of kids who would leave Maine youth detention would come back. So you can't do anything more to kids in this traditional plan A punishment kind of way, and yet it's not a deterrent. And then while kids were there, they were using restraint and seclusion an awful lot, right? So they started to work with Dr. Green, started to implement the model. Talk about a 180-degree shift in thinking.
Yeah.
Yes. And now today they have the best recidivism rate in the country. They're down around 17-ish percent. And wow. they closed a facility because they don't need it.
That's amazing.
And then the state kind of went, well, why are we waiting for kids to access the juvenile justice system to learn skills? Let's start funding schools and others to learn the model. And so there's been a few big projects in Maine to try to get the shift of other kid-centered systems towards the CPS lens of kids do well if they can and intervening proactively and upstream. So
that's awesome. And there's a couple things that you said there, and I hope I don't forget one of them, but because I do want to talk to both of them. So speaking to your last point there, here in Illinois, where I am, I have started partnering with my juvenile justice system across the state, and specifically for kids who do have IEPs, but even those who don't, I am starting to do trainings with our juvenile justice departments and help them understand exactly what we're talking about. And because some smart person in the program, in the system, decided we need to do better for our youth. And we have money to help them. So how can we allocate those funds and get the right people in to train people that are working with our youth? And the other point that you made was, yes, we've taken out restraint and seclusion, but we didn't give teachers new tools. And I mean, that is one of the reasons that teachers are flocking out of being a teacher now. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times I have, in different Facebook groups that I'm in with teachers, heard them saying, I'm out. I'm done. You know, this kid is beating me up every single day and mm-hmm. I have no help. Nobody is coming to help me. I have no other adult in my room. You know, they're screaming at me. They're yelling at me. And these are gen ed teachers. These aren't the special ed teachers that are saying this. I mean, yes, you have some, but I mean, the majority of the stories like that that I hear are from the gen ed teachers because, yeah, somehow in the wisdom of our legislators, notice I put that in quotes. they said, okay, this is bad. Let's get rid of that. But they didn't, again, think about how do you implement a better system? What do we have to do? What sort of like almost grassroots efforts? And so to hear about an organization like yours that is able to go into school systems and provide these resources for teachers and provide so many resources for free, which is just unheard of and absolutely incredible. Obviously, it's costing you all something. So can I ask, like, how do you get your funding to be able to provide all of this?
A lot of it relies on generous donors.
Okay.
Yep. A lot of what we're doing is relying on generous donors, for sure. Mm-hmm. We're able to do some scholarships for certain schools who have high levels of use of punitive interventions and high levels of disproportionate use of those interventions with Black and brown children. So schools with certain kind of demographics like that, we, through the generosity of some donors, have some scholarships that we can offer to be able to go in and work with them. We have some private grants and things like that that we're able to get, which helps things go better. We did just get a grant that was to help us work on some specific free resources for folks working with younger children. So the development of some video and downloadable stuff specific to young children that we think folks will find helpful. So yeah, it's all about our supporters, really. We're a pretty small shop trying to do some pretty big things on a shoestring, you know.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's amazing. So thank you to whoever all the donors are that are supporting Lives in the Balance, because it is definitely something that is big on my heart and has been for many years. And I'm so thankful that I was able to have this time with you today. I could sit and talk to you, I think, for hours on end about all kinds of, you know, well, what about this scenario? And what would you do here? And how would you handle this? And so I'm so very appreciative for your time today. Unfortunately, we do have to end, but I want to give you, you know, last opportunity to say whatever it is that you want to say for Lives in the Balance and yourself in general.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. And I did remember one of the things I wanted to mention. And it comes out of, we have a big Facebook presence, and one of our groups on Facebook is the B Team. That's for parents. And in there, a long time ago, somebody coined the phrase, you know, I'm trying to remember that this child is not giving me a hard time. She's having a hard time. And yes, and just really taking that to heart and doing what we can to stay curious and not get upset. And realize this is not intentional. This is not how this kid wants this to go. And this kid is hurting more than I am for having to deal with this, right? And so, you know, let's figure out how we can help this kid. And yes, there's tons of free resources to help. We have them organized. There's like some for parents, some for educators and providers, and there's some for pediatricians. We're actually in the midst of creating some for people who are in higher education, who are teaching the teachers of tomorrow and the social workers and guidance counselors of tomorrow. So we're trying to address the issue where we're not preparing our professionals for what it is they're encountering. So thanks so much for having me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And for my regular viewers, next week, Wendy Anderson will be my guest. We will be normal time, but as you've been hopefully seeing scrolling across the bottom, May 24th and May 30th are both either a different time or a different day of the week. And you definitely don't want to miss those two, because it's Mrs. D's Corner, Stephanie DeLussie, and Temple Grandin on the last Monday of the month. So thank you again for your time, Kim, and thank you anyone who is watching. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.